is going on, Nace? Welcome back to Get in the Trunk! It is time to get back in that trunk and continue this Impossible Landscapes campaign as we hurtle full steam ahead toward the epic conclusion of this adventure. Sydney said something in pre-show, which is, I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing. I'm still trying to decide as a handler. This has been a long campaign, 3 seasons long. So many episodes, so many stories these characters have been through. And Sydney feels as if this, she does not feel like the end is actually coming. It feels, quote, unresolved. This is how Vicky feels. Explain this, expound on this, if you would, Sydney.
Yeah, I think it's a bit of both. I feel like Vicky feels unresolved and Sydney feels unresolved. And I think, not that I'm a completionist. In fact, I'm the opposite. I'm like a wandering menace, I feel, in video games and in TTRPGs. But I feel, as a player, that we haven't gotten to the true core or like another major key. Like, we've had some major keys that I feel like we've unlocked. These different paths of Impossible Landscapes that sort of explain things. And I feel like for Vicky, I have to discover why she feels unresolved, because I know that she does. And perhaps it's because now, you know, her son is wrapped up in this. Perhaps it's because she has lost 2 main relationships in her life, almost 2 Delta Green. Like, she's lost them because she's been so deep in it. And yet, has not been fulfilled by Delta Green. Like, she's just in this spiral going down. So I don't know. I don't know what the resolution, I mean, maybe the resolution of all Delta Green adventures is death. I don't know.
It is an interesting idea, an interesting concept. I think that it's safe to say that that feeling unresolved and like you are spiraling down and down and down is exactly how you should feel, and exactly what Delta Green is. Yeah. It is by design, and I'm talking about the game and the fictional agency. It's like the game is designed so that it gives a true appreciation to cosmic horror, right? Which is like, you can't fight it. And you can't, and exposure to it is so deadly in terms of your life. So like, yeah, you could just physically die. But then also just being exposed to it, even briefly, can destroy your known life, you know? Yeah. And that is something that is examined pretty deeply throughout the game style or the mechanics. The agency seems to, they have their mission, their objective is stay afloat another day, right? Keep these fears at bay another day. But ultimately, they know every one of their agents will one day go insane. There's almost no way to prevent it. It's a very scary situation to enter into. And I think that we've had interesting operations where some people die, some people don't. You're affected, but you could still move on with your life. This one, exposure to the King in Yellow and the forces of Carcosa, is like, and I said this very, very early in the campaign, is quite possibly the most deadly thing anyone in Delta Green has ever faced, because it truly is so all-consuming in its ability to destroy the world. I mean, it's a fascinating thing. I don't know, Skid, do you have sort of, I don't know, what is your perspective on the King in Yellow now, having gone through this much of Impossible Landscapes, versus maybe your idea of the King in Yellow before you started it?
Well, first of all, like, I don't think that there could be anything approaching like a satisfying end to a Delta Green campaign, because there only is one ending, and it's bad.
Yeah.
It's all bad. And it's also like the thing that you're fighting against, you can't comprehend it. Like, right. As players, like, you can't get it. Like, if you could, it would ruin the experience.
Right.
So it's that there's just kind of inherently something, there's going to be some stuff that just feels that way because by design. But yeah, I mean, I definitely get the sense that the King in Yellow it's cool to have this thing with this kind of legacy in fiction to kind of brush up against it. It's very cool to like get that experience in a couple of different games and game systems in worlds now.
Yeah, it's really cool. we've dabbled in it in a lot of different ways. And I think that, yeah, while you're right that like, there is no satisfying ending, that is certainly not what I'm shooting for. I think that we can definitely have some satisfying conclusions as we come to the end of this campaign, but they're all going to, they're not going to be based on winning or losing, right? Like that's not really the identity of solution here. It's going to be the character's arc, the character's development. I mean, your characters are fascinating. And I mean, Neil, how Neil has changed from the start of Impossible Landscapes to now is just amazing. and Vicky as well. I mean, Vicky was, remember, the most sane character for most of the campaign. Was it one episode ago, maybe, that you were just... like, Neil, you have to help save Neil. And you meant it. And you were serious. And we understood why you meant it. But think about how crazy that sounds to an outsider, right? And maybe what you're doing is putting out an amazing story of what the damaging, how damaging mentally exposure to this stuff can be. Because it can turn... somebody, you believe as your character, you are being completely sane in the moment. And yet from the outside with no context, you would seem like, you know, a person that has no concept of reality. So it's very, very interesting seeing those arcs coming together. Francis, you look great today, man. I love the teal background. It's giving me like aquamarine. It's giving me Hawaii vibes, like at the beach.
Very chill over here. I like it. Very nice and cool. Crisp.
Yeah. Are you doing that to like juxtapose how you feel in the game?
Yes, yes. I'm trying to calm myself down because this is a nightmare. No. But I think like getting to that point, I feel like I'm making me think about Bobby's trajectory to like, he started out so like, grounded and like, kind of like, you know, he had like a girlfriend and had like a solid job. And then like over the course of his Delta Green missions have just been like, has devolved into this like, just monomaniacal like quest for the kernel, for some kind of power, for some kind of understanding that has just taken him deeper and deeper. And it's now like brought him to this point where we're in this just upside down world full of like just absolute chaos. And this is like somehow he's feeling more at home here than he has in like the 20 years past since he started this whole thing. It's kind of feeling
it's very eerie.
Yeah. It's real weird. It's real weird, but I think it's fitting. It makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, so much exposure for so long has made this seem normal, you know, in a way. Yeah. But yeah, when you think back, it's really kind of cool to think back of Bobby having a job at a desk, you know, in the CIA as like an analyst, basically a station chief,
a book guy.
And like a successful CIA agent, you know, relatively. Operating overseas, has his own station, you know, has a girlfriend that would love to marry him, but he's good right now. You know, he's just like...
Fuck that right up.
Yeah, you really... you fumbled that bag.
Janice.
Yeah, it's... And to see, I think part of it is your individual character development, but also what the game sets out to do, and I think you guys have done a spectacular job doing this, is showing how it is ruining the lives of your family and friends, right? Like, everything is getting destroyed by this, including the death, let's not forget, of Neil's best friend.
Oh, God, yeah.
You know?
We just forgot about her.
Like, there's a Bond who died because of even being near Neil. At any point, you know, did Neil kill her? We did see a reality where that happened too. It's very unsettling. What's her name again? I keep thinking Janice, but that's your girl, Bobby.
It's like, no, it was like Ricky or something. It was like a girl with a guy's name, wasn't it? Or no, that's it
was,
your
well, but my mom was mom. Johnny.
Oh,
yeah,
Johnny.
Right, mom was Johnny. Oh, yeah, Johnny.
Mom was. But no, you had your buddy.
I'm blanking
who was
on
like,
your other Bond at the moment.
Yeah, she was.
Was
the,
it
the
Steve
publishing.
Buscemi?
No, that's the was, new Bond.
That is a boy's name.
Yeah, Steve.
I'll find it. I'll find it eventually.
Yeah. Poor thing. We forgot her already.
I know. Does she ever exist at all? That's the question.
Troy, one of the most stable, steadfast things that people tune in for on this network is Roger Comstone. And you always know what you're going to get with Roger to a certain extent, when unless the full chaos comes out. Do you feel like he has changed during the course of this, or do you think he's the same guy he's always been? Always been crazy.
You know, I don't know. Part of it, I think, is my attention is getting worse as I get older. Like right now, all I'm thinking about is this venti iced coffee that my wife gave me. And the straw has like a hole running down it. So it's very hard to drink.
No. Yeah.
And it's also very bitter, but I'm going to drink the whole thing throughout the course of this episode. It's going to be very uncomfortable. And then I come back to your question. let me preface this by saying, let me toot your horn for a moment and say that your GMing throughout this series has been not only at the highest level of anything on the network, I think it's the highest level of anything in the industry. It goes beyond, I think, what most human beings are capable of doing. And what drives me crazy is that I have such a hard time latching on to things as a player. It's really why I don't play it as much anymore, because when I'm not driving the show, my consciousness drifts to a million other things. And so as the world of Delta of Impossible Landscapes has gotten crazier, Troy has become lost, and then Roger has become lost as well. And I think that on, at least for the latter portion, that's kind of right for Roger. Like right now, whenever we're doing stuff, I'm always like, why am I even here? I don't understand how I even got here. I don't even, like, it started, it was never really grounded in reality. It was crazy from the beginning. You know what I mean? And the night floors, everything was crazy. But now it's so crazy. When it came up last week and Vicky cornered Roger, I just was thinking, like, Roger now is in it for personal survival. Like, he almost believes that even Vicky and Neil and Bobby aren't real, and is questioning his own sense of realness. Feels like Michael J. Fox at the end of Back to the Future, like he's going to fade away. And so, like, he still has affection for these people, but he's so lost in this world, because I'm personally lost in it, that he now is just about survival. And I think over the course of the next few episodes, I'm hoping there's going to be this moment where he comes back or drifts further. I'm not sure. I'm excited to see. But yeah, he's just kind of caught in this funnel now. He's trying to get back home, but he doesn't know what exists.
Yeah. I mean, it is true. It's one of the things that's tough for me as a handler is in Delta Green as a handler, you can read the handler's guide. You are encouraged over and over again to keep the players off base and unfamiliar with what's happening and unsure of anything they think, to not trust their own minds as characters, as players all the time. And there's a place for that, but I struggle with it because I am such a logical person. I like to be able to explain, this is what happened. Point A to point B to point C is exactly why you're here and what is happening. That doesn't really exist in Impossible Landscapes. There's some aspects to it, but even if there are, your characters don't know it and have no way really to find it out. Now, there are some ways that you could find it out that you didn't do. You didn't go down certain research paths, which would have given you a little bit more light. But at the end, you would still, I think, be pretty baffled about how Carcosa interacts with the reality that you know and called your original reality versus the King in Yellow and what that entity is. All of those things, they just don't have an easy answer. And so I want everybody to kind of feel like they understand why they're here or what the mission is. But that's something I think that you have to find for each individual character. It's not something that I can give you because it's just not part of these adventures. They don't care about you having a logical step process to solve the mystery. It's just not part of the, you know, Sid, I mean, you've run these games, you've read some of these operations. They just kind of tell you large scale what has happened. Yeah. And then unleash the players on it and see what they piece together before they go insane. You know, yeah, it's really tricky.
I also know, you know, from running this for friends and stuff, they get frustrated too. And they're like, we don't have enough information. And I'm sitting there like, I don't have any other information.
Right. To I don't give either. Them.
There is no other information.
I could start lying. Like, there's making up, you know, a pretty bow tie ending. But it, yes, I think Skid was right in that we all know what the end is, and it's not a happy, good ending. It's just, yeah, it's a bit unresolved. But I think Joe, you're also right. There are things for each of our characters that will resolve themselves, whether that be in a good way, a bad way, a crazy way, whatever.
Yeah. And you guys obviously have a huge part of telling that story. As we come toward the end, you're going to be rolling die. Things are going to happen that you would want to happen or might not want to happen as players. But in either case, you have to embrace it and then tell that story in the best way that you can and give your character a satisfying end to this arc that we told, even if it is a sad ending, perhaps, you know. We just have to be prepared for that. With that, let's get back into it. By way of a brief recap, last week, you guys were tearing through the war zone. For a bit, maybe, Vicky was trying to chase Sam, who she saw as a soldier running away through the streets. You guys hear gunfire everywhere, blah, 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 blah. There's lots of strange things happening. The buildings are moving. The streets change. It's very unsettling. But Bobby, back when he had his coma, was here long enough and was exposed to a coded signal long enough that using his SIGINT skill, he was able to decode how to get to what was called the factory. The colonel told him this while he was in this other world. He said, we need to get to the factory. That's the only way through to the palace. Well, you found your way to the factory, and what you find outside are bodies everywhere. Bodies of soldiers, bodies of Russian soldiers, German soldiers, U.S. soldiers, British soldiers, all seemingly in World War II garb. You also see this Black Wind, who seems to hold the main fort, which is this factory, and Roger is able to get you in there by using a code word, but not before Neil took a bullet, went down, nearly died, but was saved, resuscitated by himself, who Vicky manifested. Wow. What a game. What a show.
Did we talk about it on air, or was it just after the show that was the Moonlight Graham moment?
Yeah, that was after the show. Yeah, we talked about it as the Moonlight Graham moment when little Archie Graham gives up his dream to play baseball in order to help the fallen child, the choking child. I mean, it's just... this child's choking to death.
The field of dreams is actually the field of dreams is actually adjacent to the impossible landscapes. We didn't know that before.
I said that before watching it. I was just like, this is just a little bit of a tonal shift away from being fucking Delta Green.
I said that in our Impossible Landscapes campaign as a show opener band. I can't remember if it was season 4 or season 5, but I was like, Skid and I just watched Field of Dreams. And I was like, after playing Delta Green, now I watch it and I'm like, how is that family not like, like running from the house, calling the police, being like,
ghosts. The wife is so accepting.
Yeah, she's like, can I make you guys some coffee? It's
Here, corn ghosts. Corn here, corn ghosts.
My husband really needs this. Here, corn ghosts.
Yeah. What bothers me more is not that this in the movie, in the fiction of the movie, was all taken at face value and just fine. It's how much Delta Green has changed my mental makeup. Like, I used to enjoy that movie this is fun. This is nice, you know? And now I can't help but think of, it's just like, these people are insane. Delta Green's going to have to put them down because they witnessed this. Like, they're going to have to kill the whole family. It's going to look like a house fire.
We're going to have to kill the whole family.
What happens to the ghosts when the game ends? Really, where do they go?
Where do they go? Exactly. Dig up that mystery.
I think James Earl Jones had the worst fate of them all. He goes in there like out of...
He's just a dude in there. Yeah. He's like, I'm a normal person. Why did I walk in here? This is horrible.
Yeah, exactly. So then you manage to get into the factory, Kurt, thanks to Roger knowing the password or guessing the password. You get inside, you see it's a tank factory, and then you're brought through the tank factory and into a clockwork factory where you see an old man tinkering with the small marionette girl, the clockwork child that Neil saw in the night floors in the McAllister 20 years ago, presented him with an invitation, and that you, who saw it, Roger and Vicky saw in a closet in the house in Boston in 2015 as it presented Abigail's note. you know, the note that we have been referring to this whole part of this adventure was presented by this clockwork child. Roger, without hesitating, just tried to shoot it and it vanished in that moment. Well, now you see it here. You see an old man tinkering with it. Roger says something along the lines of, "Hey, asshole! Hey, asshole. Hey, asshole. Do you speak our language?" or some such thing.
Yeah.
And the old man slowly turns, revealing the clockwork child that he's working on. And Bobby recognizes the old man as Mr. Kreminsky.
Right. Fucking Kreminsky.
A Bond from season 4 of Delta Green, of Get in the Trunk. Bobby's, what was he, informant or
he was,
asset?
Yeah, he was an asset that he was like keeping tabs on after he defected.
He was an asset that he was keeping tabs on after he defected. Mm-hmm. Very well said. All right, let's open right there as this old man turns his stool around. It's on wheels. It's a low sitting stool. He slowly turns to regard you. His eyes squint towards you. He says, "Who is that? Come into the light where I can see you." And he's sheltering his eyes from the bright work light that he's under. "Come closer so I can lay my eyes on you."
Nikolai.
He just sees shadows in the distance.
Nikolai Kreminsky.
"Who is that? Why do you know my name?
What are you doing here?"
"Show yourself."
Bobby steps forward into the light.
"Oh, my old friend. Oh, why did you not say something?"
And he like struggles to get up from his stool. Oh, just like I actually struggle every time when I get up from my chair.
He gets himself up. He looks at you wide-eyed. I wondered if I'd see you here, my friend."
He starts walking up to you, and he goes to, like, embrace you, like, give you a hug.
Roger pops a hand on his chest.
"Oh, what? Who is this? Who is this man? Pushes
That's
me away
friend.
As if we do not know each other, have known each other decades. What is this?
You don't touch my friend.
Colonel, please, tell him. We go way back."
"Bobby, who's this prick?"
He's somebody that shouldn't be here. This is Nikolai Kreminsky. He was a defector. He was an asset I was in charge of keeping tabs on."
"Yes, we were old friends. We worked together in the war. I've not seen you in a long time since you grow mustache. I like. It looks good, Colonel. It suits you."
"Wait, is he calling me Colonel?"
"He's calling you
he's
Colonel.
He's calling me Bobby's like, "Wait a minute. Colonel? What are you talking about?"
"Colonel William Walford, yes?
Do you mean, Colonel, do you no longer go by your title?"
Bobby's just dumbfounded. He's just sitting there like this. This doesn't make sense.
Well, perhaps you have become confused. I did not know if you could make it through, Colonel, but I'm glad to see you here now. I wanted to help. I tried sending message, but I do not know if you receive.
You sent the coded message with the coordinates.
Yes, I told the boy how to send the message, yes. Exactly. You and your men, I expected more. You said you had the whole division.
We lost some men. This is all that's left.
Well, war will do that, won't it?
And he turns around, sits back down in his stool, and slides it over to the clockwork girl. He says,
"I am very busy, but I would love to assist in any way I can. I'm glad you make it through. But where now? Where are you heading?"
"The palace. We need to get to the palace."
"Ah, of of course, and to the masquerade. You're going to the masquerade?
Yes. The party.
You have invitation? All of you?
Did we all get one? Or,
no.
It was just Neil.
Yeah, and Abigail told Vicky on the phone we all need invitation. So Vicky is looking at Bobby and just like, okay. She doesn't know who this guy is, but she's shaking her head. No.
We were short a few invitations. We need three more.
Three more, but you do have one.
Yes, we do.
Ah, well, it won't be a problem then. That is fine. But you are, of course, wearing costume, no? What are you wearing? You will not be able to attend without costume and mask and invitation. Need all three.
So, at this point, I'm thinking, Bobby's thinking, he can manifest a uniform or a costume, right? Because we're still we just got out of that that
can
crazy
always try.
Situation.
You can always try.
Okay. What is it? A sanity check or?
Yeah, sanity roll.
Sanity roll. Okay. All right. Bobby's gonna try and manifest a costume.
So he says, you'll need costume, all three things. Where is your costume? And then you're just going to poof.
Yeah, yeah. And, 52 over, very, very far over.
You want to fail that.
We want to fail that. So yeah, 52. So,
what are you attempting to manifest?
Like a costume. Just some kind of...
What exact costume?
Oh! I was thinking like a big...
Burt Lancaster.
I was thinking of like a big military, like Dr. Strangelove military costume, but like just out of control, like more like caricature-ish, like a giant hat and like a bunch of big like chest candy, like medals on his thing.
Okay. Yeah. You attempt to manifest this around yourself and nothing happens.
And then Bobby's just sitting there like,
says, what are you doing?
I was nothing. We're going to need costumes.
Roger, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, Vicky is looking around. If he's working on these clockwork things, she's looking around to see if there's anything she can put on, like clothes, a hat.
Yeah, remember I said when you walked into this space, there were mannequins everywhere, like just kind of like inert all along
dressed?
The back walls and stuff like that. Maybe, but they're in such darkness as there's only this one work light that these couple work lights he's working under. Everything else is kind of in darkness, but there are, yes, some of them seem to be clothed.
So Vicky kind of pipes up then after it looks like Bobby farts, like poops himself.
Yeah, he just goes like,
oh God. Sorry. I need a minute.
excuse me, maybe we could borrow.
Ah, yes, young lady, what is your name? O'Connell, please introduce me to your friends.
Yes, this is Maybelline.
Also, an interesting name.
Yes,
Maybelline.
Maybelline.
Richie. Maybelline. Richie.
I think he's looking at Bobby. What the fuck?
I feel like we're using
Maybelline Richie.
What's wrong with you?
Of course.
Vicky nods along. Uh-huh. That's my name.
Yes.
Yes, Maybelline Ricci. Maybe we could borrow some of these clothes off these mannequins or something?
Yes, of course. There are many things lying around. We could look for something. Yes. If you find something that suits you, you would be more than welcome to take. Yes, young man. What seems to be the problem? He's looking at Rogers.
Rogers just fucking seething. He's watching Bobby and him interact. Bobby trying to manifest a costume. Vicky politely asking if we can take the mannequin's clothes. And Rogers like, oh, I see something I can wear. And he goes up, pops him in the face, and starts taking his clothes off.
What?
He goes up to the guy and tries to...
Yeah. Just,
what?
Okay.
Don't punch that man.
I hate him. Stop pretending this is normal.
Stop pretending this is normal. He's garbed in like some old fashioned suit, like a wool suit.
I picture basically. Him as like Geppetto.
Yeah, yes. Just like Geppetto, exactly. A little messy white hair, and then this small suit as he's working on this thing. What is wrong, young man? You seem upset.
I got a costume.
And you start walking up to him. Okay. Go ahead and give me an unarmed combat roll, and I am going to fight back.
Oh, my God.
It's all so you come up. He says, "What's the problem, young man?"
Failed. 97 over 65.
Oh, holy no! Crap. I rolled a 33, which is a critical success.
Oh my god! Oh. This old man.
You go up to
the
punch this guy, and in a very strange, very like unexpected way, he grabs your arm, moves off the chair, and shoves your entire body weight into a rack, a table filled with pieces. And you crash through the table and go to the ground, and the pieces go everywhere. And he just, like, it's this old, like, almost crippled-looking man, and he made a move that was physically impossible based on your first assessment of him. You crash through the table, hit the deck. He stands up looking at you, and he says,
"That was not very kind. Colonel, get your soldiers in line, or you will never get help from me."
I apologize. He's a little war-weary. Roger, that was ill-advised.
Roger's just like...
Vicky goes over to help Roger up.
While this is going on, Neil is going around and using his artistic sensibilities. He's going to the different pieces and trying to assemble the costumes that he thinks would be appropriate.
Okay. So, Neil, you start moving around, and unfortunately, it is very dark. Do you have any means by which to light so that you could see more detail? And by the way, there aren't just mannequins. Like, that's part of it. There's these marionettes. But there's also, like, tables and tables of just stuff. And part of them are, like, folded up in discarded costumes. Part of it is, supplies, equipment. You can't really see. Everything is such a jumble in the darkness. Do you have a flashlight? I mean, you don't have that thing anymore, right? That flashlight that you had
in the... mining helmet?
The mining helmet. Yeah. You haven't had that since you passed through. That's right.
No, I guess not.
But he says, he sees you walking over, and he's like, "Would you like to take a look at what the possible costume? I can help. Your size more probably this way. Over this side." And just like turns his back on Roger, not caring, and moves with you, Neil, and starts to lead you over to another area.
Okay. I go with him, get next to him, and then just start strangling him.
Jesus Christ.
What?
Get him in a sleeper hole.
He's like, wait a minute. Let me just make it clear. He's a friend of mine, okay? You stop beating the shit out of this guy.
I love how Bobby's like, "Guys, stop it. Seriously. Stop.
Everyone gets a turn to try to murder this guy." I go with him. But I'm.
Okay.
Yeah, so I've got my eyes up. His like vision is like. Lucchino Visconti, like the leopard, like that's kind of what he's imagining. He's trying to put something like that together. That's his.
Oh, nice.
I'm sorry, concept. I don't know that reference. What is it?
It's an old Italian art film.
Starring Burt Lancaster.
Yeah, Burt Lancaster. It's like 18th century.
What's it called?
It's the leopard.
18th century Italy or something?
It's like Garibaldi, like Italy. It's like... Yeah,
19th century. 19th century.
Yeah, very, very, very fancy. Very like... So...
Okay. So sort of... I'm looking at stuff online here. So sort of...
Aristocratic.
Like aristocratic.
Dinner, like 19th dinner century blacks. Aristocratic European.
Yeah. So like white collar. Okay. So yeah, you want to dress the part of the aristocrat. Yeah. And he will move you over to this area, and almost as if he can sense what you're looking for, he takes you to the specific spot where you see several mannequins standing and wearing these different style black and whites, tuxedos and such, that go back pretty far in time and all the way up to being almost kind of modern. And there are also big piles of them, you know, along these tables as well. As you walk up closer, he reaches past one of the things and he hits a switch, and poof, zzz, up above, this light comes on over this sort of section of the area and lights everything up in a really bright way. As he lights it up, you see leaning against the back wall, just behind the oh my God, why am I forgetting the word for the mannequins? What are they called? The
dummies?
God.
Puppets? Mannequins? Marionettes.
Oh, marionettes, man. Yes. Oh, yeah. Behind the marionettes, yes. They all seem like kind of human-sized puppets, marionettes. So they're not just mannequins. They have like strings, literally, that are hanging from them down to the ground and stuff like that. You see leaning against the back wall a piece of what looks like painted, designed plywood that is leaning against the wall. It is completely painted as if a set on a stage. And as that light goes on, you see it is the wall of safety deposit boxes from the bank. Yeah. And it's completely 2D and just like a painted set sitting behind these things. He doesn't reference it at all. Neil, give me a sanity check.
Oh, man.
Your crowd's in there. You got to get it.
Your crowd's
in there. That is a critical fail.
Critical fail. 4 points of sanity damage. Oh. Max sanity damage. As Neil, you recognize, you know, you again questioning every base of reality that you have. Was that place ever real? Did it ever exist? You determine how this sanity loss manifests in the moment, but I will say he doesn't address it at all. And he says, I think this good fit, this shirt work very well with this coat. And he's just like talking through something and laying it out on a table, like you're at Men's Warehouse, just like laying it down on a table for you to examine.
I think this is all sort of coalescing his worldview, which is like that art and life are converging. They're the same. And it's also reinforcing his idea, the power that he has, the over reality, the same way that he has the power in a movie or another piece of art that he's making. It's the same thing. And so he's feeling like better and better the more insane he gets, because this idea becomes more real and stronger to him every time an incident like this takes place.
He sees you staring off it.
It's like his like assembling these costumes is him manifesting and shaping this world to his will.
That's awesome. So you'll say, I'll give you time to look in case you don't like my first choice. I'm not take it personal, but you choose what you like and don't forget. And he gives you like a little tap on the shoulder. Tap, tap. A mask as well. And you see, you know, there's these masks hanging everywhere, all different designs and anything you can imagine. And he'll walk back over to the group. Who else? Who else needs something? You, young lady, would you like to find a costume for a party?
I think while he was helping Neil, Vicky kind of was like wandering without realizing that she was looking for something specific. And maybe she's like stumbled upon, she's looking for in her mind a blue dress, like a blue gown almost. I don't want to say like wedding dress because it's so on the nose, but I feel like perhaps her subconscious was leading her in that direction just from the dreams she's had and the weird crossovers that have been happening. But yeah, something like a blue sort of gown. Maybe there's a veil involved.
A classic blue wedding dress.
Classic blue. Something blue. That's what they say. Yeah,
that's what they say. All right. So this is very interesting. You are going off on your own. And I'll say you can by yourself find another light switch and another portion. Remember, this is like airplane hangar size. This is like Gen Con size floor of just shit everywhere. And you can definitely get lost in the mix. And as you start wandering away, you are able to find access to another light. This one seems to just be like a hanging loose bulb that you turn on and it just like buzzes to life. And it lights up this area and you keep kind of like finding close to exactly what you want. And you already see, you're like, there's just dresses, beautiful dresses everywhere. And they're lavish and big and a little bit over the top. And they almost have like a Renaissance feel, some of them. Mm-hmm. You know, like really kind of hundreds of years old, and some of them even look like they are actually hundreds of years old, but well maintained, well kept. Near, you see a bluish like sleeve kind of sticking out, and as you come up to it, at this table in front of it, this piece of plywood, it's like a plywood plank that's just on top of two struts that just like are holding a bunch of random stuff. You see a clockwork arm that is loose on the table, attached to no body. And as you approach, underneath the arm, just underneath the hand, you see a slightly grease-stained piece of paper. And you can see, just sneaking out from where the hand is covering the rest of what it says, you just see it says, "My Queen." Vicky just leaned all the way back in her chair. Like she wanted to get away from the call. Get me out of this game.
I think it like catches her eye. Being an investigator also like deep in her subconscious. So she's going to slowly walk up to it and kind of peering down, she's going to try to slide the paper out of this mannequin's hand.
You go up to slide it, and it's that moment in The Departed. Remember?
Oh, yeah.
He sees the envelope. No. It's just like, wait a minute. You just see part of it, just enough of it. You start to slide it out.
Citizens.
Yes, citizens, exactly. You go to slide it out, and it just says, "To V, comma, my queen." And this is 20 years ago. This letter was sent to you, and now it looks like it's on a table of props. And if you open it, do you open it up?
Wait a second. Yeah, this was sent, and she thought it was sent by Christopher. It was left on her doorstep. Was this made by the fucking clockwork people as a fake invitation?
Oh, shit. Jeez. All you saw was a figure walking away in the night, in the rain, as you looked outside. And all of a sudden, Vicky, you start to flash. We see a stormy night 20 years ago. You're sitting there working on these files for the McAllister building. This, what's going on? Where is Abigail? Kidnapping files, thinking that, you know, and you looked out the window and you saw this figure walking away in the night. And as you relive this moment, you're standing there at the window looking down. And now it was dark then. You can see now what you never saw before, the strings that were coming up from the marionette that was walking away down the street.
Okay, I went back to the letter on our evidence board just to peek.
Oh, yeah. God.
And, I mean, there was, like, red flags, and it's signed from Chris, but there was all that weird stuff that's like, "My queen, I'm a king in exile without you." There's just, the tide was moving so slowly before I knew we were standing on different islands. There's just so many weird, "You should know you can trust me. I'll always be your backup. I have a proposal for you." Oh, gosh. Okay.
Give me a sanity check, because this is all starting to, you realize what 20 years ago they were drawing you here. Is that what was happening? Oh, give me a sanity roll.
Okay. All right. Oh, no. Oh, 14. 48 over 34. My sanity's so low now.
It's getting lower and lower. You take 3 points of sanity damage. How does that manifest in this moment? And you play it however you want. You can see how Neil played it. He was like, he's feeling better and better. Like, it's all different ways.
I think, like, Vicky...
Marionette just walking down your street. Back then, it looked like a man just walking through the rain.
It'd be horrifying.
I think this is, like, heartbreaking to Vicky. I think she starts crying, and she's remembering, like, at that time, that long ago, she was getting back together with Chris. Like, Christopher and her were working on their marriage actively, and things, like, were sort of going okay, and this letter made them meet in the park, where then they made their date to get pizza and, you know, catch up and try to, like, work things out. This is before her and Roger started actually, like, seeing one another. And I think this is absolutely heartbreaking to her. And she has this little mental twig snap in, like, the forefront of her brain. Because if that letter wasn't from Chris, if this wasn't Christopher, what was happening? Who was she talking to? Like, what did Christopher even care? Did was he going to put in the effort? Like, there's the emotional, and then there's that weird, like, mental. So she just starts crying, and as she's crying, I think she even, like, is touching the dress on this mannequin, and she's just like, I don't know. She's just losing it. She's just crying. All right.
So then you hear a voice from behind you. An excellent choice that once belonged to Casilda. What's wrong, my dear? What is wrong?
He comes around the side.
I can't do this. I can't do this.
Can't do what?
It's not real.
It's an excellent choice. It will fit very well, I think. If it doesn't fit, I will hem, I will sew. It is okay. I'll take care of it.
I can't do this. I can't do this. I can't pretend, and I can't. I don't want to be here anymore. I don't want to be here anymore. I'm done.
Where do you wish to go?
I'm going to go fucking home to Harlem, where I fucking live.
Well, the only way to go home is to go to the masquerade.
He gives you this eerie smile.
It is the only way.
You're the one who sends people shit in the mail. You're the one who forges handwriting.
Ah, no, I am not. I wish to say I could have such experience with such things, but not me. I am no forger. No, that is the scribe. He is upstairs. If you wish to meet him, I could take you.
What's his name?
He has no name. He is the scribe. He needs no name. His name is his duty. Like the colonel.
He looks across at Bobby.
I think Vicky instinctively, like, touches her side where her gun is, just feeling whether it's there or not. She just, like, feels it and has this innate urge to, like, see the scribe and, like, fucking arrest him, like, put him away, like, take him off the map. And she feels her side, and then she looks at the dress and she goes, yeah, I'll put that one on. I'll put this one on. This is the one.
Ah, excellent choice. You see, we make progress.
Turns to the rest of you.
And you, my violent friend. Perhaps we can find something that can fit you, but it will be tough. So big and strong.
Roger is, like, still brushing himself off from getting judo tossed.
Shards of wood.
Table. It's just like he feels so powerless, and he realizes, like, the one thing that he's always had is his strength, his might, his willingness to pull the trigger and end situations. It worked on the night floors. It doesn't work here. He is powerless. And so he just kind of stands up, smiles, and it's like, it's all a play.
Ah, yes, of course. It's all a play. They say, not so sure what it means, but it is, of course, all the will of the king. If the play is the will of the king, then so be it.
It's all a play. It's always been a play. We're just characters. Better get my costume. And he just starts looking around, and you tell me if this is there or not, but I imagine Roger's eyes alight on a larger mannequin that's wearing a clown suit.
Of course it's there.
Of course it's there.
Most of them are clowns, I assume.
Yeah.
And Roger says, do you have any makeup?
Oh, of course, sir, we have makeup, yes. You like the clown, do you?
Oh, yes.
Clown is very funny, good at parties. Yes, come, follow me.
I'm great at parties.
He'll walk Roger over, and Roger, you get close to this clown costume. All these marionettes sitting there. One of them is a clown. It's pretty big, but there's all kinds of clown gear in this area that he brings you over to. It's almost like you manifested it, right?
Yeah.
You imagined it, and there it is. And they're all different. You can imagine the variety of different clowns you could look like. And it's got every wig, every nose, every set of shoes, every color pants, every color top, every color buttons that you could mix and match to your liking. But it is spread over a wide area. One thing sort of stands out to you that is not in these clown costumes. And that is a mannequin that does not have a bland face, but has what looks to you like an unsettlingly real face, like a face that is made and constructed and artificial, but looks kind of real. So it's just way more bothersome than the plain-faced mannequin. And you see these strings are holding up the arms of this mannequin, and it is wearing 21st century clothes. And you see this figure just sitting there, and you recognize the face of the frat boy that accosted you in the bar with Vicky that you fucking headbutted and like put down. It's just like a college kid, but it's this inert, dead, artificial face wearing the exact clothes that that guy was wearing. Give me a sanity check.
Success, 43 under 58.
You take no points of sanity damage from helplessness as you are embracing this helplessness, I think. You are saying, it's all just a play. Better get my costume. And so you can start shopping on that.
It's going to take you a while to compile the clown costume, my friend.
I have all the time in the world.
Bobby.
He walks up to Bobby. He doesn't call you Bobby. He walks up to you, Bobby, and he says,
Colonel, now, where is the invitation? Who has it?
Neil, right?
Yeah.
Neil. He is the aristocratic gentleman.
Yes.
He will be the aristocrat tonight.
Yes, yes.
Okay. I will speak to him. What would you like to wear? Is something I can show you to.
Oh, you already said what
Yeah, Bobby was thinking of the like a caricature of a general's uniform with like a bunch of medals and like all these like adornments and whatnot, but like a military uniform.
Yeah, military general.
Yeah.
Sounds good. So he will lead you to this area where you can start searching through that stuff to build that costume as he turns back toward Neil. And he says,
the colonel tells me you have invitation from the king.
And I just turn and smile at him.
And let's say you're dressed.
Like yeah, you turn dressed, and you look like a million bucks. Like yeah. I have, especially after being shot and working your way through a war torn area for a day and a half or something. You just yeah. like in this this beautiful tux, 19th century style tux. He turns around. Ah, it fits very well. He pinches the sides by your waist, takes your shoulders, pulls them a little bit, wipes off the back. It's very good, sir. Very good choice. Yes. You have the invitation.
And I just pull it out. It's in the breast pocket of the top coat. Just pulls it out with two fingers and holds it up.
Very nice. You come with me and we can take care of everyone. Everyone! You want to come with us? We are going to make invitations. Whenever you are ready.
Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and find out who is going along, who is not, how they're going to get these invitations. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. We are back, and I think it would be, in all honesty, irresponsible to just jump right back into this narrative as these characters are putting on costumes and not take a moment to address the elephant in the room, which is Sydney's hat. it's kind of offensive that we've gone this long in the episode without mentioning it. I think we're trying to be respectful and not comment on the lady's clothes. But the fact is, Sydney does not wear a lot of baseball caps. And she looks funny. You look funny. I mean, you don't wear caps very often.
I don't wear caps. And you know what? I don't wear caps right now with this haircut because I don't know how you guys do it. The hair is meant to be worn forward. That's the cut. You know, like you style it forward. Boy, you boys, people with short hair, they get it. There's a way to style it.
Totally.
The hair's too short to, like, Francis is talking.
Francis is bald, by the way, for anyone who's never watched a video.
I'm mostly talking to Francis about
this. I'm with you.
I got you.
I haven't worn my hair back in so long since I got the cut because it doesn't really do it. It doesn't, like, style backward. My hair was, I need to shower today. Hair's, like, a little not stylable. It just didn't look good. So I threw on a baseball cap because that's what people do and their hair doesn't look good.
Yep.
But it's, like, it's just, like, crazy. It's neither.
Oh my God, it is.
Nice. Like, wow.
It looks great.
Yeah, I like it.
It's so high up in the air.
That's a look. That's a look.
You look like an untalented Annie Lennox.
But you're right, Joe. The issue is I don't really own a lot of baseball caps because I don't really wear them normally. So I grabbed a random one and we all had a funny laugh.
Describe it to the audio audience. What does it say on your hat?
So it's got like a .45s, and it looks like it could be like a .45 caliber gun.
I thought you were just advocating your guns. Sydney. Yeah, it was just your favorite caliber weapon.
Could be like decimals.
She just
math.
Loves decimals. Yeah.
she loves fractional math and handguns.
I have to come clean for the audio audience. It is an Astros hat.
I don't know if it is. I think it's. I'm researching it now. Maybe they became the Astros, but in 1962, there were an expansion team in the National League called the Houston Colt 45s.
No. That was their original name.
That was
they
their
came into the league with the Mets. So that was their original.
They
name.
They turned so into like the Astros.
And it's like, throwback. Hey, maybe we shouldn't name a professional baseball team after a gun.
And then years later, the Washington Bullets came along.
So it is, technically it's an Astros hat and it's worn in jest. It's worn in fun. It is my fiance's who does not like the Astros.
He owns Astro merch, ironically.
Yeah. Two Astros hat. And one is like a vintage undercover throwback hat.
Yeah,
so the bit is very deep. But yeah, so I wore a baseball cap. I look a little silly, but we all have bad hair days. I just have to be on camera for mine. So you know what? Let me live.
Yeah. I always put a hat on my bad hair days. I just Googled Colt 45s because Troy said he was looking it up. And I literally just typed in Colt 45 apostrophe S. Colt 45s.
And the first thing that came up is the Houston Astros' current standing in the MLB. Yes.
Like, oh, wow.
That's crazy. Like, wow. I mean, that is real. It is just the Houston Astros. That's what that is, I guess.
I had no idea.
Yeah, I had no idea.
That's weird. See,
it was funny. It was like the thing that they got caught up in the whole like fervor about the space race, like in the mid 60s.
Well, it says like, they moved on it. Astros. Yeah, they moved to the Space Age Astrodome. So then they needed a new space age name. And they just changed their name.
You just said Astrodome. Very funny.
Yeah.
The new Astrodome.
What everybody just says, Astrodome.
You have your wrong inflection on the wrong syllable. Love that movie.
Oh, well.
Before you jump back in, there's a lot that's happening here.
One more thing.
That I can't, I don't think it's... I don't think it's right to talk about in character, but there's something, and Joe, you probably can't say too much, but there's something that's reminding me a bit of adaptation here. When you were going back to the Chris letter, I went back to the board as well, and I immediately saw the script. Remember the script with like Lyra Westover talking to somebody? And it kind of feels like since the beginning, we've been in this play where everyone else knows they're in a play. Most of the people aren't real. They're like marionettes, or they're marionettes in the fake world that appear real in our world. We're in this play as unwitting actors. I guess it's not quite like adaptation, but you ever seen Schenectady, New York?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, my God, Joe, you should watch so this trippy. With Philip Seymour Hoffman. It's Philip Seymour, right?
Yeah, Philip Seymour
Hoffman. Yeah, that's Charlie another Kaufman. Charlie
Kaufman. Never even heard of it.
It's another Charlie Kaufman film. I saw it in the movie theater.
Really?
Yeah. I don't want to try and explain it.
It's unexplainable.
I explain it, I won't do it justice. Go, you would love it. But there's a lot.
I love adaptation.
Dude, you would love this.
It's on another level.
I love being John Malkovich. I've never heard of this. I just didn't follow.
Philip Seymour Hoffman, Kaufman's, Charlie Kaufman, Schenectady, New York.
Kaufman directed that one too, I think.
Yes, he did. It's very, very strange. Again, I wish I could try and describe it. You just got to watch it. But there's just like, we're unwitting players in the King in Yellow's play. We were like chosen to be his actors, and we didn't know until now, when we're powerless, that we've been set up all along, chosen to either be the queen or the like next king.
Oh God!
Maybe he's looking for successors.
Go back to that invitation. Let's look at that.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about this invitation in a second. So let's bring it back up on the John Jamsky, and you can.
Can't find it.
Where are we trying to
join us at the palace to celebrate the new king? Come to dine, come to dance, come on my face.
Oh my God! Wow,
that's
what it says.
That's in there.
I don't remember. I don't know.
I don't have my glasses.
It's in the fine print.
Come to dance.
It was
come
implied
on my
where to come.
Could you imagine if something was added to the edit board post, like in post, and we didn't realize? And we're like, oh my God, we've solved the mystery. Oh, it says, come on.
I know now what I must do.
Quick, Roger. Now is your time.
Roger, no!
This was the John invitation.
Yeah, come join us at the Palace of Masquerade to celebrate the new king.
A masquerade. Join us at the palace, period. A masquerade to celebrate the new king. Come to dine, come to dance. Come on my face. It is very
episode. We'll just call it boy.
So yeah, this is the invitation that we have. Missing, I think, something that is just not on this detail that we showed on screen here is the Ian part of this. So I'm going to say it's on this. It's not only on the envelope where it is addressed to Ian de Craig, prisoner 125101. It's also, I'm sorry, that's Ian Frederick de Craig. It says to Ian on the invitation inside, which is an important distinction. So, Neil pulls out and shows this invitation to Kremensky, who then announces to all of you that we are going to make invitation. If you like to come, you want to meet the scribe, right? Pointing to Vicky. The scribe will make your invitation.
And Vicky, again, like feeling, she's now wearing this dress and feeling at her side, like for her gun. which is not
there. And it's there.
Sweet.
And she, yeah, she, it's concealed. I think she like ripped the stitching in the side of the dress a little bit so she could just like reach inside and take out her gun, which is still inside the dress. So she feels it and she nods.
He'll wait sufficient time if anybody else wants to come. If you want to get dressed first or want to, because he says you have to go upstairs to the scribe. Neil, are you going to follow?
Yeah.
And are you getting a mask?
Gotta bring the invitation, the original.
Have you chosen a mask yet?
Yeah, the Burt Lancaster.
Burt Lancaster. Big mustache.
The one, whatever looks the most like Burt Lancaster, that's the one
I'm Got taking. It.
Stepping out from the rows of mannequins. a giant clown. Kind of looks like Bill Murray in Quick Change.
Nice.
Except he's got the Bozo the Clown like side hair. You know, like too long.
Yeah, bald tops. On top.
The right. most frightening.
But possibly. Like the outlines are so all white. The red lips and stuff. The fucking nose.
Goddamn.
My favorite thing, by the way, in that movie is when it's like at the beginning of the movie, there's a guy like passing out flyers in front of a strip club. It's like, live girls. Bill Murray walks by the clown outfit. He's like, clowns, welcome. Clowns, welcome.
He directed that too.
Yeah. It's a good movie.
It's a good movie.
It's weird. So yeah, he's kind of got this weird. Quick Change Bozo the Clown type thing, but he's enormous. And he's wearing like oversized overalls. Big floppy feet.
God, this is amazing.
A puffy shirt. It's like, I'm ready for the dance.
It's like Crazy Joe Davola.
Yeah, it's Crazy Joe Davola.
Roger, did you conceal any weapons coming in here like Vicky did?
Roger always thinks he has weapons on his person. Two shotguns, several handguns, grenades. But so far, every time he's tried to reach for one, he can feel like it's there. But every time he pulls his hands up, he knows it's there, but it's not manifesting into his position. Mm-hmm. So in his mind, he thinks tucked into his oversized pants are several weapons. Two shotguns and a couple of handguns.
Okay. You go to feel them, and you feel the hard, cold steel.
That's not a gun.
Of shotguns in each pant leg. You were just thinking this, and now they're there.
It feels.
Bobby, did you found your military costume, and what is your mask?
Yes. He's going to grab like a, you know, those like old samurai kind of like.
Oh, like, yeah, like the face, like the monster face.
Yeah,
thing.
They have like the face, like frowned upside down, kind of like weird, yeah. like angled, like eyebrows and stuff like that. One of those, yeah. And
he's okay. just like a Japanese samurai mask.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
With this military costume. Yeah, very cool. Very cool. Costume. Like a overly ceremonial, military, high ranking
totally.
Costume. Okay?
Totally. Yeah.
And then Vicky. Does she pick a mask? She has this gorgeous blue Renaissance dress. It looks like it could have been worn at court in like the 1700s.
Yeah, I think she picks a mask that's like...
Ronald Reagan.
This is going to be Point Break. Yeah. This is going to be Point Break.
It's like one of those latexy rubber Ronald Reagan. Big eye holes. No, she picks a... It's like a very old porcelain mask that has like blue ribbon that you would tie it to your head. And it's painted almost like pale, very pale peach, almost white. And it has kind of like pink painted lips that are like bows, like outside of where a normal smile would be. And then like painted thin little eyebrows. My grandparents had these weird porcelain clowns that they kept in a cabinet, like figurines. They would go on cruises and collect, you know, stuff from like China, Japan, India. And they
stuff had these, like, or clowns from different countries.
They had a lot of clowns, actually.
That's frightening.
But there were these
that
like
so
really
scary. Imagine being a child sleeping in that house.
Nightmare.
There was coming really out to get you,
Mr. Marbles.
Thin, like, beautiful clowns that had these, like, porcelain faces, you know, with the lips that are, like,
Yeah.
So it's not quite a clown mask. It's almost like a little girl porcelain mask.
Like a doll. Like, one of those
like a doll. Like a doll.
Like a doll's mask.
Like a doll's mask.
Doll's mask.
I love it. Okay. He starts leading Neil upstairs, and assuming the rest of you follow, there is at the far end of this cavernous space, there is a wooden set of steps that is just like bolted into the wall. And he walks up and there's a landing and then turns and then landing and then it turns, and you're going up about three stories before you get to a doorway at the top there. He enters in with Neil right behind him, and then the rest of you following in line. He moves down a hallway and eventually turns into an open room that had no doorway. But this room opens up and it seems to be very, Christ, I want to look up the right, I want to say Baroque. Is that the right word?
Like extremely gaudy,
yes.
Beautiful.
Yes. Yeah. So I just, it was like the word that popped into my head, but I just Google image searched it. Yes. And you see these images of cathedrals and the paintings of the inside of these Gothic cathedrals and stuff like that. Like, that's the vibe. Mm. He walks into this room and you see this. It's kind of skid like the rotunda at the Capitol in a way. Like, we walked into that underneath the Capitol rotunda, and there's like, it's a circular room with a domed top, not nearly as high as the U.S. Capitol, but a domed top with this artwork all over the ceiling. And the artwork is of just at a single glance, you can see that it is war and battle, men on horses with rifles, and then the lake, the city. You can see all the moons, the suns. You can see all these elements that like make up Carcosa. These big, heavy drapes hanging down the walls they're all embroidered with all kinds of incredible detail. And then, as you pass through the doorway and look up at this, just as if you would be tourists visiting a Baroque site in Europe today, there is a purple velvet like rope stanchion line that is like keeping you from walking further into the room, but it's just, you know, it's laid out in front. Beyond this purple velvet rope stanchion line, sitting in the middle of the room, or in the middle of the room, is a desk and a man sitting behind it, dressed in this 17th century Baroque outfit with like the frilly collar around the outside, like the wide frilly collar, head down.
Is it a Baroque collar?
Let's just keep saying Baroque.
Baroque.
It's a Baroque-ass collar.
It's got this Baroque-type face.
If it's not Baroque, don't fix it.
There it is.
Boom. Bottle cap.
And you see this man sitting at this desk, hands both on the table. As you're looking to the left of the man, there is a wooden tray that is smallish. It's a small wooden flat tray that seems like it could fit papers, like filing papers or something like that. And in front of the man and to you at the front of the desk is a pile of paper, perfectly ordered stack of what looks like hundreds of pages of paper stacked in the center. And an ink pot and a quill. And upon closer examination, even just a couple seconds into the room, you see that this man is a marionette. That this is a doll that is just sitting there and inert. Once you're all inside, Kremensky says,
present the invitation, and the scribe will make one for you. Right there, you see the tray. You put it in the tray.
and he's talking to Neil.
Alright, step forward. Sort of loathes to give this up even for a second, but he sort of hesitantly lays it down.
As soon as you cross the velvet ropes, this marionette sort of like spools to life. You see no strings. And it reaches over, grabs a quill, dips it in the ink, and immediately, like, I mean, so fast, it's like a, you know, like a robot, like, whoop, picks up the quill, reaches out, grabs a single slice of paper, a piece of paper, and just sets it down and just starts scribbling on this piece of paper as you're approaching. You walk up, and you're intent to set this invitation in the wooden tray, and as you get closer, it stops and sits up. You come around the side of the tray, and you can see on the paper, it says in handwriting so perfect it almost looks like a typewriter. It says, "Agents enter the room." Neil does not recognize the scribe. And then it just sits back. Go ahead and give me a an alertness roll.
Jesus.
That is a fail.
Fail, okay. You notice nothing else, and he had told you to put it in into the tray.
All right. I say, "Elephant butt." Just looking at what he's writing.
And he writes down, "Neil, dot, dot, elephant butt." And then sits back.
I nod sagely and place the invitation in the tray.
You see just like kind of slightly in italics, says, "Neil," in all caps, and then small, "nod sagely." Places the invitation in the tray. And then the paper is pushed to the side, and the scribe reaches out and grabs the invitation, sets it down. Instead of pulling from this thing in front of him, the scribe slides back, opens a drawer of the desk. As it opens the drawer of the desk and bends down, I literally opened the drawer of my desk, bends down into the center drawer, you can see as soon as it bends that behind it, its clothes are not fully wrapping around the back. And in the back, you can see all the whirring machines of what is making this thing move. And oh man, this is a tricky one. I'm trying to remember if you ever got upstairs at Barbas's house.
Yeah, we saw this.
Yeah,
the
everybody
scribe.
Did. I know Vicky and Roger
there
did.
Because I saw the thing that I think it was called the scribe, or it was talking
called
to the scribe.
The scribe.
Yeah, right. And then I saw somebody in a. I was trying to see who was on the second floor, and when I got up there, there was
the
somebody
scribe
there.
Attacked us all.
But
too,
there was a closet
it?
Where I bent down and I saw a bookshop and all
bookstore.
That.
Bookstore.
Didn't it attack us in the living room too? It attacked us all.
There
in
were
the living
two
room?
Of them. There was like one that
no,
was like
that. That
different.
Was the lion.
The lion
attacked you, and it was extremely dangerous.
Right.
Yeah. This was not the paper lion. This was the clockwork lion. And then you also saw the scribe. I couldn't remember, Neil, if you were up there and saw it. But in this moment, as it bends over and you see some of its inner workings, you recognize it as identical. It is the same machine, except with a like porcelain marionette frame built around it to make it look like a man. You know what I mean? Like the scribe that you saw at Barbara's house is the same machine, except without a head or a body around it, and just without legs, just sitting on a table.
Right.
But the central aspect of it is the same machine. Anyway, you recognize this, and it pulls out a template paper that is of the exact same paper quality and has the pre-designed like columns on the side that are in the design of the invitation. And it just leans down and writes to Neil. Come to the palace, a masquerade to celebrate, and starts copying it identically
to what you had put down, finishes, slides it to the right side, and then just sits back again, inert.
Well, so this is useful. Like, we need something with each of our individual names on it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
now you have one.
Okay.
I think at this point, Bobby walks up. We're all in the same room, right?
Boom. Paper comes down. All caps. The Colonel walks up. It's writing exactly like what's happening, moment by moment.
That's crazy. And he picks up the invitation that Neil just placed down and puts it again back in the same spot, like himself, to trigger the scribe.
Got it. Colonel William Walford. To Colonel William Walford. And then begins to write out the invitation. What is going through your head, Bobby? Because this is not you.
No.
But he's... Somehow, in this place, they are referring to you as if you are your father.
This is kind of, in Bobby's mind, this is what he's been looking for this his whole life, is to become the Colonel, to be in the place where he thinks the Colonel is to being, like, in control and knowing all the ins and outs of what this whole crazed world is. Like, he believes the Colonel has the answers, and he has always wanted to assume the Colonel's role. So this is like, he's been waiting for this. He's like excited. He's happy to have Kremensky call him Colonel William Walford, and happy to have this invitation written out to him. He's like assuming the role.
He is becoming his father, and perhaps is his father. Does that lose his identity at all?
He doesn't. He thinks.
Or does he not care?
He doesn't care. He thinks this is better than his identity. He thinks this is like him becoming what he's always wanted, which is.
And you can see him there with the ceremonial military garb.
He's all puffed up in his uniform.
Japanese samurai mask. Yeah. Copies the invitation, sets it to the side. And then on to who would like to go next?
Roger looks at Vicky.
Vicky looks at Roger.
I'll go. Roger walks up and says, "The king walks towards the doll."
Roger, dot, dot, "The king walks towards the doll."
"Give me an invitation," the king says.
"Give me an invitation," the king says. Writing down everything you're saying as you're saying it. Putting the invitation in the left box, it copies it. Roger. To Roger. The same notation and everything, and sets it to the side again, inert. And now, Roger, you spent a lot of time with this scribe. You recognize it exactly for what it is.
"Jim Palmer was the winningest pitcher of the 1970s.
"Jim Palmer was the winningest pitcher of the 1970s.
That's right.
That's right. Give me the goddamn invitation. Roger takes the invitation. Vicky, you said you wanted to see this scribe, and you were gently grabbing at a gun as you spoke of it.
Yeah.
Shit.
How does she feel now seeing this machine copying these invitations?
I mean,
this machine perhaps wrote this letter and made it look like Christopher's handwriting.
She still wants to destroy it, but she's also thinking like back to Barbas's apartment house where it was also a machine. Like, these are literally puppets on a string controlled by somebody else. So destroying this is not going to destroy the creator, you know, the king, whatever. She does really want to shoot it. God, she wants to shoot it in the head.
You and your 45s, you love it.
Me and my 45s.
Obsessed with shooting things.
Is Roger done?
Roger's done, and slowly Kreminsky turns and looks at you.
So she will walk up in her beautiful, broke, blue dress. And she'll walk up to this mechanical thing.
This marionette. And it describes you walking forward toward it. Copies an invitation for you. The same as the others if you're not speaking. And then in italics, all caps, Vicky, V-I-C-K-I-E, right?
V-I-C-K-I.
All right, V-I-C-K-I, all caps, V-I-C-K-I. Thinks of killing the scribe.
Ooh. And she sees this. And
it's not looking at you. It just sits back and inert.
Did it already do the invitation?
Yes.
She, Francis.
I knew it. She's gonna do it.
She wants to, turn the head of the scribe toward her. And she wants to look at it to see if she recognizes, does she know this person? They've known a lot of people here, or thought they've known people here.
You grab at its jaw and go to turn it. It turns toward you, and it is a completely plain-faced, white, almost featureless face. It's just like a mannequin head, basically. There is the sense of a nose, the sense of a mouth, but there's no eyes. It just turns, and you look into its face, and it's just a machine.
You know what to do.
She's like holding it, and she's going to take her gun, and she's going to put it into the mouth hole, and she's just going to pull the trigger.
I've rubbed off on you.
Yeah.
That's my for girl. Initiative. All right. In the initiative sense, that's my girl.
Roger lays her over the desk, just pushes down the paperwork.
Oh my God.
We'll just give him a few minutes.
That would be their thing. Like killing stuff, and Roger would be like, who? Baby.
Where is this Richie Ben?
It's been years.
Okay, Vicky just pulls the trigger, and blah, the thing fire rockets kind of back and off the chair. It starts twitching in the. Let's say it falls down onto the ground, and we'll say that it rises back up. And, sorry, wrong thing. It rises back up and makes some sort of move to swing. However, Neil will get to act first.
Oh, we really are in initiative right now.
Oh, yeah, that was not a joke.
That was for real.
Shoots it, and its head is broken. Half of it is blown off. The back is blown off. But you can see the body is still kind of rising up.
Neil is just—he's just gonna sort of back away a little bit.
Back away a little bit, okay.
Yeah.
Roger
sees this happen, remembers what just happened when he tried to attack Kreminsky, and thinks, now knows you can't fuck around here, and so I think his instinct is to try and grab Vicky like an explosion's about to happen and pull her down. So he's gonna run towards Vicky and try and no.
Vicky, are you willing?
Yeah, I think she's shocked at what she just did. Why did she do that? She has the gun out. Her hand is still there where the creature was. And Roger's pulling her, and she's kind of just looking and going with him.
Wow. Okay, Bobby.
Fuck. I think that kind of just startled him awake. But wow. I mean, is it Is it doing anything other than just twitching on the floor? It's just twitching on the floor.
It's beginning to stand up. Like, it's okay. Standing up as if it's could attack. I don't know. It's just not as fast as you guys, so I'm giving you this. It has a lower dex, so I'm giving you this option to...
Okay.
To act. You could just do nothing. You could just delay or ready.
Yeah, I think Bobby's just watching this happen, watching to see what it's going to do.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just going to wait.
It's its turn. Rises up off the floor, half of its face blown off, and it takes one hand against the desk and whoo, and just fires the desk, and it just like flips head over heel, whoo, 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 and shatters in the side of the room.
My bad.
And then begins to walk to Vicky and reaches this hand out and starts going faster and gets up to her face, but doesn't have any more actions. Its real action was pushing this desk out of the way and moving towards you as Roger's pulling you back. It's reaching for you. Neil, what do you do? Superhuman strength, this thing just, whoa!
Neil is going to, Dr. Manhattan style, just reach out and just and separate all of its molecules from each other. It's going to vaporize.
Oh my God.
Okay, give me a sanity roll.
Neil is living his best life in this place.
64 over 20.
Down to 20. All right. And then pal times 5.
Okay. Oh my God.
Fail. 91.
Okay. Neil, you reach out and you start to feel as if you are literally like unspooling screws that are inside of it. You're literally starting to like dismantle the clockwork inside of it, but it's not quite there. It's like starting to happen, but the thing still is an inch away from Vicky's face. And remember, you're in this round room. I'll say all of you are between it and the door and the purple velvet rope, and Kremensky is on the other side. He's just standing there. He hasn't acted, and he's just staring. And it's Roger's turn. All right. So it's coming at you too, Neil, but you're kind of off to the side a little bit.
All right, from his back, Roger will reach for that cold steel he felt in his baggy pants. Pull out the shotgun and from his back, fire this buckshot at this fucking mannequin.
Okay, go ahead. Give me a firearms roll.
Ooh. All right, so that's a 56, and I believe that's under. Let me make sure without my glasses. Under 81.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
LT under 81.
56 under 81, and it is extremely close range. Do you don't have the damage handy, I assume.
I do.
I believe it's 2d6 and change for the shotgun.
Let's see. Shotgun. Is it slug or shot? Slug is 2d6. Shot is 2d10.
It's shot, so it is 2d10.
Let's
at
go.
Close range.
12 points of damage.
Boom.
Woo.
12 points of damage. Boom! Roger pulls the trigger on this thing and it like blows it back a good like 5 or 6 feet. It stumbles back, breaking a lot of the internal mechanisms of it, but it is still standing. It's like really, really, really fucked up, but not down on the ground yet. Bobby.
Fuck. Kerminsky is not... He's not near us? Is that...
He's behind the velvet rope near the outside of the room, and he's just standing there, completely emotionless.
Shit. Shit. I don't think he... Bobby doesn't have any weapons on him, if I remember correctly. Unless he I guess he's going to try and manifest a weapon then.
What weapon?
Oof.
What weapon did you have on you before?
He didn't.
A blow dart.
The only thing he manifested was a
flat-lattle.
Was
did you have a gun?
I think the last time I had a gun was before we were. Yeah, before we left.
Just think fast. What does Bobby imagine in this the heat of the moment in a split second?
Hmm. You know what? He's going to manifest a samurai sword.
There you go. Oh, yeah, remember we had there was a katana in the play, if you remember, in the backstage.
Oh, yes.
But it was foam. This time, you are in full military garb with the samurai mask, You've got a katana in a sheath.
Yes.
In your belt, like pointed off to the side in your belt. You reach down in front of your belly, and there is a grip of a beautiful katana.
Oh, shit. He just goes, pulls it out, one move, slices its fucking head off.
Okay. Give me your melee weapons.
Wow.
I don't know. You cheat, son of a bitch.
It's the thing where the katana is like sheathed again. Yeah. Like it was so fast. Yeah, it was just like, it's just in the head like
this is gonna be awesome.
Melee weapons.
Melee weapons. Oh, that's not bad. Okay. Ooh, 59 under 60.
Oh.
Ooh, yeah.
59 under 60.
Wow. Yeah, that's good, 60 buddy. The melee that's weapons, great. Baby.
Holy. Baby.
I knew that would come in handy sooner or later.
Nice work. Okay, I love it. Give me 1d8.
1d8. Oh, goodness.
Just
whoosh. There you go. 6.
Nice. 6 is enough as you decapitate it in one slice. This thing, its head comes off and it starts sparking. And it's already all mangled up on the inside. Not hitting the ground, but Vicky, one more split second. It's your turn. Is there anything that you do? It seems like it's going down.
Yeah, Vicky wants to just like crescent kick. Where, like, you kick your leg up and it goes in, like, a half circle, and then you snap your heel down into the ground. She just wants to, like,
sick.
Stomp. That's what
is Vicky trained in martial arts?
I'm just saying. It doesn't look like a professional crescent kick. I'm just saying. She wants to, like,
looks like an amateur crescent kick.
It's an impossible landscape. Anyway,
right, give me an unarmed attack.
She just walks up and wants to stomp on it. Unarmed. Wow. I should have use my gun, which I'm good with, but I wanted to step on it.
Yeah,
so.
That's more gratifying.
Oh, but what's my unarmed? 50. Okay, so 30 under 50.
Wow. There you go. So, whoom, you kick your leg out, and then as this thing is going down, you just accentuate, boom, and drive it into this Baroque rug. Boom. And its pieces break and fall apart. It twitches, and seems to, quote unquote, die under your feet. Nice. And you are out of danger. Kremensky's standing at the back. Why did you do that?
Because it was awesome.
He's looking at Vicky. Why did you do that?
It's mail fraud.
Sandy! Oh, that was good.
Well played.
Well played. Oh, Sid! Amazing.
Oh, she's breathing great. Heavy. It was male fraud.
Your gun.
Wow. He nods. Okay.
We all have jobs, Kremensky. You understand. I couldn't let him live.
You godless commie heathen. You don't understand.
Yeah. She that's literally what she says. She kind of mumbles it like a crazy person, but that is how she felt.
That's that tracks. I mean, everybody's losing it. It makes sense.
Wow. That's amazing. He says, well, and looks to the side of the room.
You should pick up your invitations. It is time to go. The masquerade is about to begin.
And as it threw the desk, your invitations were flown. Any that didn't grab it already. So is it only Vicky? Or did everybody else grab their invitation? Or was Vicky's the only one still on the desk? Was Roger still on the desk in that moment? How did you imagine it?
I imagine Bobby picking it up after he finished it. After the scribe same. Finished
right after he
it.
Finished
yeah.
it.
Yeah, same.
Same with Roger?
Yep.
All right, so Vicky, it was mail fraud. And then she, you walk over, find your invitation in a mix of all these papers on the floor. Do you remember being upstairs at Barbas's house and there were the invitations to the dinner with Barbas?
Yes.
And they were all the errored ones. Mm-hmm. Vicky, you have this flash as if you're there in that moment. Like you're in Barbas's room with everything spilled and you can see all of your names. You see your addresses. You see your son's name written on these things that you're sending out these letters, an invitation to a frat party. You see it in the mix on the floor here again. And you see a Baroque rug and you blink and then it's just the wood paneled floor of Barbas's house. And then you blink again and it's the Baroque rug of this Baroque room. And you feel the baroqueness of all this getting into your head. But you see your invitation there sticking out from all of it.
Yeah, shakily, she kind of like picks it up. God, she just wants to set this room on fire. But she just backs up back toward the group.
And Kremensky will turn and walk out of the room, leaving the wreckage of the scribe and the broken desk in this area and just turning and walking away. You all follow?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
At this point, he says, as I've said, the masquerade is about to begin. And he starts walking down the steps back down into the warehouse. You won't have much time. You need to go quickly. It is through that way. You must cross the gardens, and then you'll see the palace gates. He looks at your weapons. The guards will search you for your weapons. Cannot take them into the masquerade, so if you wish to get them in there, you better find a way to sneak them by.
What if we kill the guards?
I would not advise that. It will prevent you from getting into the masquerade. There are always more guards.
He says ominously.
How am I going to conceal my gun?
Yeah. What, would have thought of something more practical if I knew I was going to conceal it. Put this sword.
You could just say it's a prop sword.
It's my cane.
Yeah, yeah, it's a prop sword.
It's part of the costume.
It's part of the costume.
There you go. Yeah, yeah, it's part of the costume.
I'm the shotgun clown.
The famous shotgun clown.
Surely you've heard of the shotgun clown.
The famous shotgun clown of Biloxi.
I cannot have the shotgun, it ruins the whole costume.
Kids love the shotgun.
Kids love the shotgun.
It was terrible meeting you. I've not enjoyed a second of this. And I hope.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. You seem to have really leaned into your costume. I thought you were having fun.
I hope if there's a way for you to die, it happens painfully and slowly.
There is no way for me to die.
I suspected as much.
Perhaps you will find a way for yourself.
Or perhaps not. There is much to see at the masquerade. There are many endings at the end of that party. I'll be interested to see what yours is.
And he just kind of scans over each one of you.
Colonel, good luck.
Kremensky.
He'll come over and offer a hand to shake.
He reaches out,
grabs your hand and he pulls you down into a hole.
I was thinking about pulling out the sword, just chopping him off.
He shakes your hand. Good luck, my friend.
I'll see
the
you.
Only way out is through.
Yes.
And he turns around, and like the Geppetto comparison Troy made earlier, just sort of limps back to his little stool under his work lights and starts speaking to the little clockwork girl.
Oh, would you like this wheel is not working so well? We'll fix it. We'll fix you right up.
And you see the doorway exit where he said you needed to go. What do you do?
Go to the party. Bobby does a heel click, straightens out his suit, his uniform, starts stepping towards the door.
Everybody else?
Yeah.
Anything else you want to add before you start walking?
a military general, an aristocrat, a lady of the court, and a giant clown. Exit the clockwork factory and very briefly walk along a cobblestone street. And in the background, you see the rising palace that you have been growing ever closer to over the course of this period in Carcosa. And now its gates are within your sight. You see, laid out before it, the gardens. The large area of beautiful, sculpted grass, trees, and bushes that call to you invitingly to enter the palace through that way. And you see right at the front of it a large Arc de Triomphe. You pass underneath this arch and you see that you are looking at an exact replica of Washington Square Park. Or perhaps Washington Square Park is the replica of this.
Oh, what?
Across on the other side of this garden, you see tall iron gates. This is presumably your destination, and you begin moving through the park. As you get near the central fountain, to your left are two benches that look strangely familiar. You can see yourself sitting there with Agent Marcus 20 years ago, talking about a girl who went missing in her Murray Hill apartment. And up next to the fountain, exactly where you saw it before, a small clown regards Roger. It is doing a little dance. It stops, sees you in your regalia, and nods imperceptibly. And we'll pick it up there next time.
Oh.
Jesus Christ.
Oh, clown, so clown. Many things. So many things.
Clown. Clowny clown.
Oh, God.
Oh.
Oh my God! He's like, who is the clown outfit?
He's like, who is this clown?
Yeah, this clown.
Oh God.